Did you know Microsoft has officially ended support for Windows 10? Upgrade to Windows 11 with an LG Gram laptop. Voted PC Mag's Reader's Choice Top Laptop Brand for 2025. Thin and ultra lightweight, the LG Gram keeps you productive anywhere. And Windows 11 gives you access to free security updates and ongoing feature upgrades. Visit lgusa.com/iHeart for great seasonal savings on LG Gram laptops with Windows 11. PC Mag Reader's Choice used with permission. All rights reserved.
This is a LibriVox recording. All LibriVox recordings are in the public domain. For more information or to volunteer, please visit LibriVox.org. Recording by Leon Meyer. Essays in Radical Empiricism by William James. Chapter 7. The Essence of Humanism. Humanism is a ferment that has come to stay. It is not a single hypothesis or theorem, and it dwells on no new facts. It is rather a slow shifting in the philosophic perspective, making things appear as from a new center of interest or point of sight. Some writers are strongly conscious of the shifting, others half unconscious, even though their own vision may have undergone much change. The result is no small confusion in debate, the half-conscious humanists often taking part against the radical ones, as if they wish to count upon the other side. If humanism really be the name for such a shifting of perspective, it is obvious that the whole scene of the philosophic stage will change in some degree if humanism prevails. The emphasis of things, their foreground and background distribution, their sizes and values, will not keep just the same. If such pervasive consequences be involved in humanism, it is clear that no pains which philosophers may take, first in defining it, and then in furthering, checking, or steering its progress, will be thrown away. It suffers badly at present from incomplete definition. Its most systematic advocates, Schiller and Dewey, have published fragmentary programs only, and its bearing on many vital philosophic problems has not been traced except by adversaries, who, scenting heresies in advance, have showered blows on doctrines, subjectivism and skepticism, for example, that no good humanist finds it necessary to entertain. By their still greater reticences, the anti-humanists have, in turn, perplexed the humanists. Much of the controversy has involved the word truth. It is always good in debate to know your adversary's point of view authentically, but the critics of humanism never define exactly what the word truth signifies when they use it themselves. The humanists have to guess at their view, and the result has doubtless been much beating of the air. Add to all this great individual differences in both camps, and it becomes clear that nothing is so urgently needed at the stage which things have reached at present as a sharper definition by each side of its central point of view. Whoever will contribute any touch of sharpness will help us to make sure of what's what and who is who. Anyone can contribute such a definition, and without it, no one knows exactly where he stands. If I offer my own provisional definition of humanism now and here, others may improve it. Some adversary may be led to define his own creed more sharply by the contrast, and a certain quickening of the crystallization of general opinion may result. Section 1. The essential service of humanism, as I conceive the situation, is to have seen that though one part of our experience may lean upon another part, to make it what it is in any one of several aspects in which it may be considered, experience as a whole is self-containing and leans on nothing. Since this formula also expresses the main contention of transcendental idealism, it needs abundant explication to make it unambiguous. It seems, at first sight, to confine itself to denying theism and pantheism. But in fact, it need not deny either. Everything would depend on the exegesis. And if the formula ever became canonical, it would certainly develop both right-wing and left-wing interpreters. I myself read humanism theistically and pluralistically. If there be a God, he is no absolute all-experiencer, but simply the experiencer of widest actual conscious span. Read thus, humanism is for me a religion susceptible of reasoned defense, though I am well aware how many minds there are to whom it can appeal religiously only when it has been monistically translated. Ethically, the pluralistic form of it takes for me a stronger hold on reality than any other philosophy I know of, it being essentially a social philosophy, a philosophy of co, in which conjunctions do the work. But my primary reason for advocating it is its matchless intellectual economy. It gets rid not only of the standing problems that monism engenders, problem of evil, problem of freedom, and the like, but of other metaphysical mysteries and paradoxes as well. It gets rid, for example, of the whole agnostic controversy by refusing to entertain the hypothesis of trans-empirical reality at all. It gets rid of any need for an absolute of the Bradleyan type, avowedly sterile for intellectual purposes, by insisting that the conjunctive relations found within experience are faultlessly real. It gets rid of the need of an absolute of the Royceian type, similarly sterile, by its pragmatic treatment of the problem of knowledge, a treatment of which I have already given a version in two very inadequate articles. As the views of knowledge, reality, and truth imputed to humanism have been those so far most fiercely attacked, it is in regard to those ideas that a sharpening of focus seems most urgently required. I proceed, therefore, to bring the views which I impute to humanism in these respects into focus as briefly as I can. Section 2. If the central humanistic thesis, printed above in italics, be accepted, it will follow that, if there be any such thing at all as knowing, the knower and the object known must both be portions of experience. One part of experience must, therefore, either 1. Know another part of experience, in other words, parts must, as Professor Woodbridge says, represent one another instead of representing realities outside of consciousness. This case is that of conceptual knowledge. Or else, 2. They must simply exist as so many ultimate thats or facts of being in the first instance, and then as a secondary complication, and without doubling up its entitative singleness, any one in the same that must figure alternately as a thing known and as a knowledge of the thing, by reason of two divergent kinds of context into which, in the general course of experience, it gets woven. Footnote. This statement is probably excessively obscure to anyone who has not read my two articles, Does Consciousness Exist? And A World of Pure Experience. End footnote. The second case is that of sense perception. There is a stage of thought that goes beyond common sense, and of it I shall say more presently, but the common sense stage is a perfectly definite halting place of thought, primarily for purposes of action. And so long as we remain on the common sense stage of thought, object and subject fuse in the fact of presentation, or sense perception. The pen and hand which I now see writing, for example, are the physical realities which those words designate. In this case, there is no self-transcendency implied in the knowing. Humanism here is only a more comminuted Identitätsphilosophie. In case one, on the contrary, the representative experience does transcend itself in knowing the other experience, that is, its object. No one can talk of the knowledge of the one by the other without seeing them as numerically distinct entities, of which the one lies beyond the other and away from it, along some direction and with some interval that can be definitely named. But if the talker be a humanist, he must also see this distance interval concretely and pragmatically, and confess it to consist of other intervening experiences, of possible ones, at all events, if not actual. To call my present idea of my dog, for example, cognitive of the real dog, means that as the actual tissue of experience is constituted, the idea is capable of leading into a chain of other experiences on my part that go from next to next, and terminate at last in vivid sense perceptions of a jumping, barking, hairy body. Those are the real dog, the dog's full presence for my common sense. If the supposed talker is a profound philosopher, although they may not be the real dog for him, they mean the real dog, are practical substitutes for the real dog, as the representational is a practical substitute for them, that real dog being a lot of atoms, say, or of mind stuff, that lie where the sense perceptions lie in his experience as well as in my own. Section 3. The philosopher here stands for the stage of thought that goes beyond the stage of common sense, and the difference is simply that he interpolates and extrapolates, where common sense does not. For common sense, two men see the same identical real dog. Philosophy, noting actual differences in their perceptions, points out the duality of these latter and interpolates something between them as a more real terminus. First, organs, viscera, etc., next, cells, then, ultimate atoms, lastly, mind stuff, perhaps. The original sense termini of the two men, instead of coalescing with each other and with the real dog object, as at first supposed, are thus held by philosophers to be separated by invisible realities with which, at most, they are conterminous. Abolish now one of the percipients, and the interpolation changes into extrapolation. The sense terminus of the remaining percipient is regarded by the philosopher as not quite reaching reality. These only carry the procession of experiences, the philosopher thinks, to a definite, because practical, halting place somewhere on the way towards an absolute truth that lies beyond. The humanist sees all the time, however, that there is no absolute transcendency even about the more absolute realities thus conjectured or believed in. The viscera and cells are only possible percepts following upon that of the outer body. The atoms, again, though we may never attain to human means of perceiving them, are still defined perceptually. The mind stuff itself is conceived as a kind of experience, and it is possible to frame the hypothesis, such hypotheses can by no logic be excluded from philosophy, of two knowers of a piece of mind stuff and the mind stuff itself becoming confluent at the moment at which our imperfect knowing might pass into knowing of a completed type. Even so, do you and I habitually represent our two perceptions and the real dog as confluent, though only provisionally, and for the common sense stage of thought. If my pen be inwardly made of mind stuff, there is no confluence now between that mind stuff and my visual perception of the pen. But conceivably, there might come to be such confluence, for in the case of my hand, the visual sensations and the inward feelings of the hand, its mind stuff, so to speak, are even now as confluent as any two things can be. There is, thus, no breach in humanistic epistemology. Whether knowledge be taken as ideally perfected, or only as true enough to pass muster for practice, it is hung on one continuous scheme. Reality, however remote, is always defined as a terminus within the general possibilities of experience, and what knows it is defined as an experience that represents it, in the sense of being substitutable for it in our thinking because it leads to the same associates, or in the sense of pointing to it through a chain of other experiences that either intervene or may intervene. Absolute reality here bears the same relation to sensation as sensation bears to conception or imagination. Both are provisional or final termini, sensation being the only terminus at which the practical man habitually stops, while the philosopher projects a beyond in the shape of more absolute reality. These termini for the practical and the philosophical stages of thought respectively are self-supporting. They are not true of anything else, they simply are real. They lean on nothing, as my italicized formula said. Rather does the whole fabric of experience lean on them, just as the whole fabric of the solar system, including many relative positions, leans, for its absolute position in space,
on any one of its constituent stars.
Here again one gets a new identitas philosophiae in pluralistic form. Section 4. If I have succeeded in making this at all clear, though I fear that brevity and abstractness between them may have made me fail, the reader will see that the truth of our mental operations must always be an intra-experiential affair. A conception is reckoned true by common sense when it can be made to lead to a sensation. The sensation, which for common sense is not so much true as real, is held to be provisionally true by the philosopher just insofar as it covers, abuts at, or occupies the place of, a still more absolutely real experience, in the possibility of which, to some remoter experient, the philosopher finds reason to believe. Meanwhile, what actually does count for true to any individual trower, whether he be philosopher or common man, is always a result of his apperceptions. If a novel experience, conceptual or sensible, contradict too emphatically our pre-existent system of beliefs, in 99 cases out of 100 it is treated as false. Only when the older and the newer experiences are congruous enough to mutually apperceive and modify each other, does what we treat as an advance in truth result. Having written at this point in an article in reply to Mr. Joseph's criticism of my humanism, I will say no more about truth here, but refer the reader to that review. In no case, however, need truth consist in a relation between our experiences and something archetypal or trans-experiential. Should we ever reach absolutely terminal experiences, experiences in which we all agreed, which are superseded by no revised continuations, these would not be true, they would be real, they would simply be, and be indeed the angles, corners, and linchpins of all reality, on which the truth of everything else would be stayed. Only such other things that led to these by satisfactory conjunctions would be true. Satisfactory connection of some sort with such termini is all that the word truth means. On the common sense stage of thought, sense perceptions serve as such termini. Our ideas and concepts and scientific theories pass for true only so far as they harmoniously lead back to the world of sense. I hope that many humanists will endorse this attempt of mine to trace the more essential features of that way of viewing things. I feel almost certain that Messrs. Dewey and Schiller will do so. If the attackers will also take some slight account of it, it may be that discussion will be a little less wide of the mark than it has hitherto been. End of Chapter 7 of Essays in Radical Empiricism by William James.
This is a LibriVox recording. All LibriVox recordings are in the public domain. For more information or to volunteer, visit LibriVox.org. This reading by Carl Manchester, 2006. Essays in Radical Empiricism by William James. Chapter 8. The Notion of Consciousness. Translated by Carl Manchester. A communication made in French at the 5th International Congress of Psychology in Rome, April 30th, 1905. I'd like to tell you about a few doubts that I've had on the subject of the notion of consciousness that currently rules our psychology papers. We normally define psychology as the science of the events of the conscious mind, or of the phenomena, or even the states of the conscious mind. Whether we suppose that it is related to personal egos, or whether we believe it to be impersonal, in the manner of the transcendental ego of Kant, of the Bewusstheit, consciousness, or the Bewusstsein überhaupt, general consciousness, of our German contemporaries, consciousness is always considered to have its own essence, absolutely distinct from the essences of material things. It has the mysterious gift of representing and knowing. Material facts, considered in their materiality, are not felt. They are not objects of experience. They do not refer to anything. In order for them to take the shape of the environment in which we have the experience of living, they must appear. And this fact of appearing, over and above their mere existence, is the consciousness that we have of them. Or, perhaps, according to the panpsychist hypothesis, the consciousness they have of themselves. This is the deep-seated dualism that it seems impossible to banish from our view of the world. The world may well exist in its own right, but we know nothing of it because, for us, it is purely the object of experience, and it is an indispensable condition of this effect that it is witnessed, that it is known by a spiritual subject or subjects. Object and subject. These are the two legs without which it seems that philosophy cannot take a single step. Every school of thought agrees on this. Scholastic, Cartesian, Kantian, Neo-Kantian, all posit a fundamental dualism. Contemporary positivism or agnosticism, which likes to think that it furthers natural science, admittedly adopts quite contentedly the name of monism. But this is only monism in name. It posits an unknown reality, but tells us that this reality presents itself always under two aspects: consciousness on one side and matter on the other, and these two sides remain as irreducible as the two fundamental attributes of Spinoza's God, extension and thought. At heart, contemporary monism is pure Spinozism. So how should we think of this consciousness which we are so inclined to suppose exists? We tell ourselves it is impossible to define, but we each have a direct intuition of it. Straight off, consciousness is conscious of itself. Ask the first person you come across, man or woman, psychologist or layperson, and they will tell you that they feel themselves thinking, enjoying, suffering, wanting, just as they feel themselves breathing. They perceive their spiritual existence directly as an internal current. It is active, light, fluid, delicate, diaphanous, if you will, and the absolute opposite of anything material. In short, subjective existence appears to be not only a logical necessity in order for there to be an objective world that appears, but also to be part of our own direct experience, as much as is our own body. How, then, can we avoid recognising the dualism between ideas and things? How can we doubt the complete heterogeneity between feelings and objects? Supposedly scientific psychology accepts this heterogeneity in the same way that the old spiritualist psychology did. How can it not be accepted? Each science arbitrarily marks out a field in the framework of facts, where it settles, and whose contents it describes and studies. Understandably, psychology chooses for its domain the field of facts about consciousness. It postulates them without assessing them. It opposes them to facts about matter and, without assessing those either, it links them to consciousness with the mysterious thread of knowledge or perception, which is seen as a third type of fundamental and ultimate fact. In following this path, contemporary psychology has celebrated great triumphs. It has been able to sketch the evolution of conscious existence, conceiving of it as adapting further and further to its physical surroundings. It has been able to establish a dualistic parallel between mental and cerebral events. It has explained illusions, hallucinations, and, to an extent, mental illness. These are great steps, but there remain many problems. General philosophy, above all, whose task is to scrutinize postulates, finds paradoxes and obstacles where science carries on regardless. It is only the devotees of popular science who remain credulous. The deeper we look into things, the more we find enigmas. And I'll say for my part that, since I've taken up psychology seriously, the old dualism of thought and matter, the allegedly absolute heterogeneity of these two essences, has always given me difficulties. I'd like now to tell you about a few of those difficulties. Firstly, there is one which I'm sure will have occurred to all of you. Take our perception of the external, the direct sensation which tells us, for example, of the walls of this room. Can we say in this case that the psychological and the physical are absolutely heterogeneous? On the contrary, they are so little heterogeneous that, if we take a common sense point of view and rid ourselves of explanatory stories about molecules and waves in the ether, for example, which are essentially metaphysical concepts, if, in a word, we take reality naively as it appears to us from the start, this palpable reality on which our vital interests depend and on which our actions are carried, well, this reality and the sensation we have of it are, at the moment the sensation appears, absolutely identical. Reality is perception itself. The words "walls of this room" only signify this fresh, echoing whiteness that surrounds us, interrupted by these windows and bounded by these lines and angles. Physics, in this case, has no different content than psychology. Subject and object merge. Berkeley was the first to bring credit to this truth. Esse est percipi, to be is to be perceived. Our sensations are not little internal copies of things, they are the things themselves. so long as the things are present to us, and whatever we might want to think about the life of things which are absent, hidden, or, so to speak, private, and whatever the hypothetical constructs we make of them, it remains the case that the public life of things, the actuality of which they present to us, from which we get our theoretic constructs, and to which they must return and reattach themselves or else float in the air and in unreality, this actuality, I say, is homogeneous, and not only homogeneous, but numerically one with a certain part of our internal life. Here's how it is for our perception of the external. When we consider imagination, memory, or the faculties of abstract representation, although the facts here are much more complicated, I believe that the same basic homogeneity emerges. To simplify the problems, let's start by excluding tangible reality. Let's take pure thought, as it appears in a dream or daydream, or in a memory of the past. Here again, doesn't the stuff of experience play two roles? Don't the physical and the psychological merge? If I dream of a golden mountain, it certainly does not exist outside the dream, but inside the dream, it is in essence, or in nature, perfectly physical. It appears to me as physical. If at that moment I allow myself to remember my house in America and the details of my recent voyage to Italy, what is it that happens? What is the pure phenomenon? It is, let's say, my thought and its content. But still, what is this content? It takes the form of a part of the real world. To be sure, this part is 6,000 miles and 6 weeks away, but it is linked to the room where we are now by masses of things, objects and events. Homogeneous on the one hand with the room, and on the other with the object of my remembering. This content doesn't start as a tiny internal fact which I then project. It presents itself immediately as the distant event itself. And what is the consciousness that I have of the act of thinking this distant content? Is there any other way of naming the content other than retrospectively, once we've separated it from the physical intermediaries and reattached it to a new group of associations which bring it back into my mental life, the emotions which it awakens in me, for example, the attention I pay to it, the ideas I've just gone through, which the memory aroused. It is only in relation to these later associations that the phenomenon is classed as a thought. If it were related only to its earlier associations, it would remain an objective phenomenon. It is true that we are accustomed to compare our internal images to objects, and we consider them as little inferior carbon copies or duplicates. An object presents vivacity and clarity which are superior to those of an image of it. The object thus contrasts with the image, and, to borrow Taine's excellent term, it acts as its reducer. When the two are present together, the object comes to the fore, and the image retreats, becoming something absent. But what is the object itself which is present? What is it made of? The same stuff as the image. It is made of sensations. It is a perceived thing. Its esse is percipi, and it and its image are homogeneous, generically so. If I think of my hat that I left just now in the cloakroom, where is the dualism, the disjoint, between the imagined hat and the real hat? It is a real absent hat with which my mind is occupied. I think of it, for practical purposes, as if it were a reality. If it were present on this table, the hat would provoke a movement of my hand. I would pick it up. In this same way, this conceived or imagined hat will soon determine the direction of my steps. I will go out to get it. The idea I have of it will continue up until the point where the hat is tangibly present, when it will harmoniously dissolve. I conclude, therefore, that whilst there is dualism for practical purposes, because images are different from objects, take their place and bring us to them, there is no reason to say that they are essentially different in nature. Thought and actuality are made of the same thing, the stuff of experience in general. The psychology of external perception leads us to the same conclusion. When I see an object in front of me, such as a table of such and such a shape, and such a distance, it is explained to me that this experience is down to two things. To a material sensation which comes through my eyes and brings the element of exterior reality, and to ideas which awake in me, meet this reality, class it, and interpret it. But who can tell, within the table concretely perceived, what is sensation and what is idea? External and internal, extended and unextended, fuse together and become inseparable. This recalls the circular panoramas, where real objects, rocks, grass, broken wagons and so on, which occupy the foreground, are ingeniously linked to the canvas that makes up the background, representing a battle or a landscape, so that it is hard to tell the object from the painting. The seams and joints are imperceptible. Could it happen like that, if the object and the idea were completely different in nature? I am convinced that similar considerations to these will have also already provoked doubts in you about the alleged dualism of the world. And there are other reasons to doubt which arise. There's a whole realm of adjectives and attributes which are not either wholly objective or subjective, but which we use sometimes in one sense and sometimes in another, as if enthralled in their ambiguity. I'm talking about the qualities that we appreciate in things, to put it one way. The ethical or moral aspects of things, their value to us. Where, for example, is beauty to be found? Is it contained in a statue, in a sonata, or in our souls? My colleague at Harvard, George Santayana, has written a book on aesthetics, The Sense of Beauty, where he calls beauty objectified pleasure. It's true that, in this context, we could talk about projection to the exterior. We think of a pleasant warmth and of a sensation of pleasant warmth in the same way. The rarity and preciousness of a diamond seem to us essential as qualities. We might speak of a terrible storm, or a detestable man, or a shameful act, and we think ourselves to be speaking objectively, even though these expressions are about nothing more than our own emotional sensibilities. We even talk about a wretched journey, a glum sky, a kind breeze, or a cruel midday heat. This animist way of looking at things, which seems to have been the style of primitive man, is very easily explained. And Mr. Santayana, in another recent book, The Life of Reason, has made this explanation. By the tendency to attribute to an object the things we experience in its presence. The division of subjective and objective comes from a sophisticated act of reflection, which we are wont to defer on many occasions. When practical necessity doesn't pull us towards it, it seems as if we prefer to delude ourselves with vagueness. Secondary qualities such as heat, sound and light themselves no longer have vague explanations. For practical purposes, and as far as common sense is concerned, they are absolutely physical and objective. For the physicist, they are subjective. For him, they are the form, mass and movement which give rise to an external reality. For the philosophical idealist, on the other hand, form and movement are just as subjective as light and heat, and only the unknown thing itself, the noumenon, enjoys a complete non-mental existence. Our private sensations retain some of this ambiguity. There are illusions of movement which prove that our primary sensations of movement are generalized. It is the whole world, including us, that moves. We currently distinguish our own movement by reference to the movement of the objects around us, and among those objects we can discern some that remain still. But it is from a vertiginous height that we today fall back to a primary lack of differentiation. You are all no doubt aware of the theory that wants to make emotions the sum of bodily and muscular sensations. It has caused a lot of controversy, and we're yet to see universal agreement around one opinion on the matter. You will also be aware of the controversies over the nature of mental activity. Some hold that it is a purely spiritual force and that we have an immediate perception of it as such. Others claim that what we call mental activity, effort or attention, for example, is only the conscious aspect of certain operations to which our body plays host. Muscular tensions in the head and throat, the stop and go of breathing, the flow of blood, and so on. However these controversies are resolved, their existence clearly proves one thing. It is very hard, maybe even impossible, to know, simply by private inspection of certain phenomena, whether they are physical in nature, occupying extended space and so on, or whether they are purely mental and internal. We must always find reasons for putting forward an opinion. We need to find the most probable way of classifying the phenomenon, but at the end of the day, It may be that all our usual classifications are motivated more by practical necessity than by some faculty we may have for perceiving two ultimate, distinct essences, which together make up the framework of existence. Each of our bodies gives us an almost violent sense of contrast with the outside world. Everything coming from inside the body is more private and important to us than that which comes from elsewhere. It is identified and classified with our ego. Who really knows how to distinguish soul, life, and breath? Even our private images and memories, which only act on the physical world by the intermediary of our body, seem to be part of that body. We treat them as internal. We class them with our emotions. It has to be said, basically, that the question of the dualism of mind and matter is a long way from being finally resolved. And that's the end of the first part of my lecture. Ladies and gentlemen, I wanted to instill in you my doubts and the reality, as well as the importance, of the problem. Myself, after long years of hesitation, I have come to understand my position clearly. I believe that consciousness, as it is commonly represented, whether as an entity or as pure activity, but in any case as fluid, unextended, diaphanous, empty of proper content, but knowing itself directly, in a word, spiritual, is, I say, a pure chimera. The totality of concrete realities that the word consciousness ought to cover deserves a completely different description. A description of the kind that a philosophy that pays attention to facts and that knows how to make an analysis will from now on be able to provide, or rather, to begin to provide. And this brings me to the second part of my lecture. It will be much shorter than the first, because if I develop it to the same extent, it will be far too long. For this reason, I will restrict myself only to some indispensable remarks. Let us say that consciousness, or Bewusstheit, conceived as an essence, an entity, an activity, an irreducible part of each experience, should be suppressed, that the fundamental and, so to speak, ontological dualism should be abolished, and that we should suppose to exist what we have up until now called the content, the inhalt of consciousness. How can philosophy extricate itself from the vague sort of monism that results? I'm going to attempt to give some positive suggestions, although I'm afraid that, without the necessary development, my ideas will not shed much light, but perhaps it will be enough to indicate the starting point of the journey. Why do we cling so tenaciously to the idea of consciousness existing over and above the content of things? Why do we complain so forcefully that anyone who denies this must be conveying a poor joke rather than an idea? Is it not to rescue the undeniable fact that the content of experience not only exists immediately and intrinsically, but that each part of that content has a hold, so to speak, on its neighbours? It takes account of itself and of the others, comes out of itself in a way in order to make itself known, and in this way all the field of experience becomes transparent from one part to another, or constituted like a space filled with mirrors. This binary nature of the parts of experience, knowing on the one hand that they have their own properties, and on the other that they relate to other parts and are known themselves, is noted and explained by the dominant idea of a fundamental dualism in the make-up of each individual piece of experience. In this sheet of paper, it is said, there are not only contents, whiteness, thinness, and so on, but also the secondary fact of consciousness of the whiteness and thinness. This function of being related, of being part of a whole, more comprehensive framework of experience, we make into an ontological fact, and we make a home for this fact inside the paper itself, coupling it with its whiteness and thinness. It is not an extrinsic relationship, as we suppose. It is part of the phenomenon itself. I think, basically, that we represent reality to ourselves as being made in the same way as the colours in a painting. First of all, there are coloured things that correspond to the content, and there is a medium, oil or paste, that holds them in place and corresponds to consciousness. This is a complete dualism, in which, through certain procedures, we can separate each element away by subtraction. In this way, we can be sure that by making a great effort of introspection, we can catch our consciousness in action as a pure spiritual activity, almost completely neglecting the things it is focusing on at any given moment. Could we not, I ask, just as easily reverse this way of viewing things? Let us suppose that the principal reality is neutral, and let us call it by a name that is still ambiguous, such as phenomenon, datum, or Vorfindung, finding. Personally, I like to use the plural, and I call it pure experiences. This is, if you like, a monism, but it is an altogether rudimentary monism, absolutely opposed to the binary so-called monism of Spinozist scientific positivism. These pure experiences exist and succeed one another, entering into relationships with one another which vary infinitely. These relationships are themselves an essential part of the framework of experiences. There is consciousness in these relationships, just as there is consciousness in their destinations. The result is that groups of experiences notice and distinguish one another, and that the same single experience, given the grand variety of these relationships, can play a role in several groups at once. In this way, it can be classed as a physical phenomenon in a certain context of its neighbours, whereas in another grouping it figures as an event of consciousness, in the same way that the same particle of ink can appear simultaneously in two lines, one vertical and one horizontal, provided it is situated at their intersection. To help fix our ideas, let's take the experience we are now having of the place we are in, of these walls, this table, these chairs, this space. In this full, concrete and undivided experience, just as it is, the objective physical world and the personal interior world of each of us meet each other and merge, just as lines merge at their intersection. As a physical thing, this room relates to the rest of the building, a building of which we know and understand nothing. It owes its existence to a whole story of financiers, architects and workers. It weighs on the earth. It will last an uncertain amount of time. If a fire breaks out, the chairs and tables inside will quickly be reduced to ashes. As a personal experience, on the other hand, something reported, something known, something we are aware of, this room can be seen in different ways. Its antecedents are not workers, they are the respective thoughts we have had just now. Soon it will be a fleeting fact in our biographies, associated with pleasant memories. As a mental experience, it doesn't weigh anything, and its structure isn't combustible. It exercises no physical force except on our individual brains, and many of us will deny even this influence. Whereas the physical room has a relationship of physical influence to everything else in the world. And yet, it is absolutely the self-same room in both cases. Although we are not engaged in speculative physics, and although we're looking at things from the point of view of common sense, the room we see and feel is very much the physical room. Of what are we speaking then, if not of that which, made of the same part of material nature as our souls at this same moment are embracing, enters, just as it is, into the present and personal experience of each of us, and which our memories will regard forever as an integral part of our histories. It is absolutely the same stuff, which at the same time, depending on the context we consider, is the material and physical fact, or the fact of personal consciousness. I think, therefore, that we should shy away from treating consciousness and matter as being different in essence. We can't derive either one by subtraction, neglecting the other part of an experience made of two parts. Experiences are, on the contrary, simpler in nature in the first place. They become conscious in their entirety, and they become physical in their entirety. It is by way of addition that this comes about. As long as experiences last, entering into relationships of physical influence, stopping each other, warming each other, lighting each other, and so on, we take from them a distinct group which we refer to as the physical world. As long as, on the other hand, they are fleeting and physically inert, and they arrange themselves in no fixed order but seem rather to be following emotional caprices, we take them to form another group, which we refer to as the psychological world. It is by entering right now into a great number of these psychological groups that this room becomes something of which we are conscious, something reported, something known. Because it will, in future, become part of our biographies, it will not be followed by the silly, monotonous repetition of itself over time, which characterizes its physical existence. It will be followed instead by other experiences, which will be discontinuous with it, or which will have the strange sort of continuity that we call remembering. Tomorrow, it will have taken its place in each of our past lives. But the various presents, to which all those pasts will be linked, will be very different from the present which this room will enjoy tomorrow as a physical entity. But this line of reasoning will take us too far. I can't go into all the hidden recesses of the theory of consciousness, or of what you Italians call nosology. I'll have to content myself with short remarks or simple suggestions, which are, I fear, all too obscure for lacking the necessary development. Allow me then to sum up, too briefly and in a dogmatic fashion, with the following six theses. 1. Consciousness, in its ordinary meaning, does not exist, any more than does matter, to which Berkeley dealt the final blow. 2. What does exist, and forms the truth that the word consciousness retains, is the tendency of the parts of experience to be reported or known. 3. This tendency is explained by the fact that certain experiences can lead one to another via intermediary experiences, which are clearly characterized in a way so that some play the role of things that are known and others play that of subjects that are understood. 4. You can perfectly well define these two roles without stepping outside the framework of experience itself and without invoking anything transcendental. 5. The designations subject and object, represented and representative, thing and thought, signify, therefore, a practical distinction which is of little importance, but which is of a functional order only, and not ontological, as classic dualism would have it. 6. All said and done, things and thoughts are not at all fundamentally heterogeneous, but are made of the same stuff, a stuff that cannot be defined as such, but only felt, and which can be called, if we wish to name it, the stuff of experience in general. End of chapter 8 of Essays in Radical Empiricism by William James.
This is a LibriVox recording. All LibriVox recordings are in the public domain. For more information or to volunteer, please visit LibriVox.org. Essays in Radical Empiricism by William James. Chapter 9. Is Radical Empiricism Solipsistic? If all the criticisms which the humanistic Weltanschauung is receiving were as sachgemäß as Mr. Bode is, the truth of the matter would more rapidly clear up. Footnote, B.H. Bode, Pure Experience and the External World, Journal of Philosophy, Psychology, and Scientific Methods, Volume 2, 1905, page 128. End footnote. Not only is it excellently well written, but it brings its own point of view out clearly, and admits of a perfectly straight reply. The argument, unless I fail to catch it, can be expressed as follows. If a series of experiences be supposed, no one of which is endowed immediately with the self-transcendent function of reference to a reality beyond itself, no motive will occur within the series for supposing anything beyond it to exist. It will remain subjective, and contentedly subjective, both as a whole and in its several parts. Radical empiricism, trying as it does to account for objective knowledge by means of such a series, egregiously fails. It cannot explain how the notion of a physical order as distinguished from a subjectively biographical order of experiences ever arose. It pretends to explain the notion of a physical order, but does so by playing fast and loose with the concept of object of reference. On the one hand, it denies that such reference implies self-transcendency on the part of any one experience. On the other hand, it claims that experiences point. But, critically considered, there can be no pointing unless self-transcendency be also allowed. The conjunctive function of pointing, as I have assumed it, is, according to my critic, vitiated by the fallacy of attaching a bilateral relation to a term a quo, as if it could stick out substantively and maintain itself in existence in advance of the term ad quem, which is equally required for it to be a concretely experienced fact. If the relation be made concrete, the term ad quem is involved, which would mean, if I succeed in apprehending Mr. Bode rightly, that this latter term, though not empirically there, is yet noetically there, in advance. In other words, it would mean that any experience that points must already have transcended itself, in the ordinary epistemological sense of the word transcend. Something like this, if I understand Mr. Bode's text, is the upshot of his state of mind. It is a reasonable-sounding state of mind, but it is exactly the state of mind which radical empiricism, by its doctrine of the reality of conjunctive relations, seeks to dispel. I very much fear, so difficult does mutual understanding seem in these exalted regions, that my able critic has failed to understand that doctrine as it is meant to be understood. I suspect that he performs on all these conjunctive relations, of which the aforesaid pointing is only one, the usual rationalistic act of substitution. He takes them not as they're given in their first intention, as parts constitutive of experience's living flow, but only as they appear in retrospect, each fixed as a determinate object of conception, static, therefore, and contained within itself. Against this rationalistic tendency to treat experience as chopped up into discontinuous static objects, radical empiricism protests. It insists on taking conjunctions at their face value, just as they come. Consider, for example, such conjunctions as and, with, near, plus, towards. While we live in such conjunctions, our state is one of transition in the most literal sense. We are expectant of a more to come, and before the more has come, the transition, nevertheless, is directed towards it. I fail otherwise to see how, if one kind of more comes, there should be satisfaction and feeling of fulfillment, but disappointment if the more comes in another shape. One more will continue, another more will arrest or deflect the direction in which our experience is moving even now. We cannot, it is true, name our different living ands or withs, except by naming the different terms towards which they are moving us. But we live their specifications and differences before those terms explicitly arrive. Thus, though the various ands are all bilateral relations, each requiring a term ad quem to define it, when viewed in retrospect and articulately conceived, yet in its living moment any one of them may be treated as if it stuck out from its term a quo, and pointed in a special direction, much as a compass needle, to use Mr. Bode's excellent simile, points at the pole, even though it stirs not from its box. In Professor Hüfting's massive little article in the Journal of Philosophy, Psychology, and Scientific Methods, footnote, volume 2, 1905, pages 85 through 92, end footnote, he quotes a saying of Kierkegaard's to the effect that we live forwards, but we understand backwards. Understanding backwards is, it must be confessed, a very frequent weakness of philosophers, both of the rationalistic and of the ordinary empiricist type. Radical empiricism alone insists on understanding forwards also, and refuses to substitute static concepts of the understanding for transitions in our moving life. A logic similar to that which my critic seems to employ here should, it seems to me, forbid him to say that our present is, while present, directed towards our future, or that any physical movement can have direction until its goal is actually reached. At this point, does it not seem as if the quarrel about self-transcendency and knowledge might drop? Is it not a purely verbal dispute? Call it self-transcendency or call it pointing, whichever you like. It makes no difference, as long as real transitions towards real goals are admitted as things given in experience, and among experiences, most indefeasible parts. Radical empiricism, unable to close its eyes to the transitions caught in actu, accounts for the self-transcendency, or the pointing, whichever you may call it, as a process that occurs within experience, as an empirically mediated thing, of which a perfectly definite description can be given. Epistemology, on the other hand, denies this, and pretends that the self-transcendency is unmediated, or, if mediated, then mediated in a super-empirical world. To justify this pretension, epistemology has first to transform all our conjunctions into static objects, and this, I submit, is an absolutely arbitrary act. But in spite of Mr. Bode's maltreatment of conjunctions, as I understand them, and as I understand him, I believe that at bottom we are fighting for nothing different, but are both defending the same continuities of experience in different forms of words. There are other criticisms in the article in question, but as this seems the most vital one, I will, for the present at any rate, leave them untouched. End chapter 9. This recording is in the public domain.
Essays in Radical Empiricism by William James, chapter 10. Mr. Pitkin's Refutation of Radical Empiricism. This is a LibriVox recording. All LibriVox recordings are in the public domain. For more information or to volunteer, visit LibriVox.org. Mr. Pitkin's Refutation of Radical Empiricism. Although Mr. Pitkin does not name me in his acute article on radical empiricism, I fear that some readers, knowing me to have applied that name to my own doctrine, may possibly consider themselves to have been in at my death. In point of fact, my withers are entirely unwrung. I have indeed said that to be radical, an empiricism must not admit into its constructions any element that is not directly experienced. But in my own radical empiricism, this is only a methodological postulate, not a conclusion supposed to flow from the intrinsic absurdity of trans-empirical objects. I have never felt the slightest respect for the idealistic arguments which Mr. Pitkin attacks, and of which Ferrier made such striking use. And I am perfectly willing to admit any number of noumenal beings or events into philosophy if only their pragmatic value can be shown. Radical empiricism and pragmatism have so many misunderstandings to suffer from that it seems my duty not to let this one go any farther uncorrected. Mr. Pitkin's reply to me perplexes me by the obscurity of style which I find in almost all our younger philosophers. He asks me, however, two direct questions which I understand, so I take the liberty of answering. First, he asks, do not experience and science show that countless things are experienced as that which they are not, or are only partially? Note, Mr. Pitkin inserts the clause, by reason of the very nature of experience itself. Not understanding just what reason is meant, I do not include this clause in my answer. I reply, yes, assuredly, as, for example, things distorted by refractive media, molecules, or whatever else is taken to be more ultimately real than the immediate content of the perceptive moment. Secondly, if experience is self-supporting in any intelligible sense, does this fact preclude the possibility of A, something not experienced, and B, action of experience upon noumenon? My reply is, assuredly not the possibility of either. How could it? Yet in my opinion we should be wise not to consider any thing or action of that nature, and to restrict our universe of philosophic discourse to what is experienced, or, at least, experienceable. Note, elsewhere in speaking of reality as conceptual or perceptual experiences, the author says, this is meant merely to exclude reality of an unknowable sort of which no account in either perceptual or conceptual terms can be given. It includes, of course, any amount of empirical reality independent of the knower. End of chapter 10.
This is a LibriVox recording. All LibriVox recordings are in the public domain. For more information or to volunteer, visit LibriVox.org. This reading by Carl Manchester, 2007. Essays in Radical Empiricism by William James. Chapter 11. Humanism and Truth, Once More. Mr. Joseph's criticism of my article, Humanism and Truth, is a useful contribution to the general clearing up. Footnote. Humanism and Truth first appeared in Mind, October 1904. It is reprinted in The Meaning of Truth. Mr. H.W.B. Joseph's criticism, entitled Professor James on Humanism and Truth, appeared in Mind, January 1905. End footnote. He has seriously tried to comprehend what the pragmatic movement may intelligibly mean, and if he has failed, it is the fault neither of his patience nor of his sincerity, but rather of stubborn tricks of thought which he could not easily get rid of. Minute polemics, in which the parties try to rebut every detail of each other's charges, are a useful exercise only to the disputants. They can but breed confusion in a reader. I will therefore ignore as much as possible the text of both our articles, mine was inadequate enough, and treat once more the general objective situation. As I apprehend the movement towards humanism, it is based on no particular discovery or principle that can be driven into one precise formula which thereupon can be impaled upon a logical skewer. It is much more like one of those secular changes that come upon public opinion overnight, as it were, borne upon tides too full for sound or foam, that survive all the crudities and extravagances of their advocates, that you can pin to no one absolutely essential statement, nor kill by any one decisive stab. Such have been the changes from aristocracy to democracy, from classic to romantic taste, from theistic to pantheistic feeling, from static to evolutionary ways of understanding life, changes of which we have all been spectators. Scholasticism still opposes to such changes the method of confutation by single decisive reasons, showing that the new view involves self-contradiction, or traverses some fundamental principle. This is like stopping a river by planting a stick in the middle of its bed. Round your obstacle flows the water, and gets there all the same. In reading Mr. Joseph, I am not a little reminded of those Catholic writers who refute Darwinism by telling us that higher species cannot come from lower, because minus nequit gignere plus, or that the notion of transformation is absurd, for it implies that species tend to their own destruction, and that would violate the principle that every reality tends to persevere in its own shape. The point of view is too myopic, too tight and close, to take in the inductive argument. You cannot settle questions of fact by formal logic. I feel as if Mr. Joseph almost pounced on my words singly, without giving the sentences time to get out of my mouth. The one condition of understanding humanism is to become inductive-minded oneself, to drop rigorous definitions and follow lines of least resistance on the whole. In other words, Mr. Joseph may probably say, resolve your intellect into a kind of slush. Even so, I make reply, if you will consent to use no politer word. For humanism, conceiving the more true as the more satisfactory, Dewey's term, has to renounce sincerely rectilinear arguments and ancient ideals of rigour and finality. It is in just this temper of renunciation, so different from that of Pyrrhonistic scepticism, that the spirit of humanism essentially consists. Satisfactoriness has to be measured by a multitude of standards, of which some, for aught we know, may fail in any given case, and what is more satisfactory than any alternative in sight may to the end be a sum of pluses and minuses, concerning which we can only trust that by ulterior corrections and improvements a maximum of the one and a minimum of the other may some day be approached. It means a real change of heart, a break with absolutistic hopes, when one takes up this view of the conditions of belief. That humanism's critics have never imagined this attitude inwardly is shown by their invariable tactics. They do not get into it far enough to see objectively and from without what their own opposite notion of truth is. Mr. Joseph is possessed by some such notion. He thinks his readers to be full of it. He obeys it, works from it, but never even essays to tell us what it is. The nearest he comes to doing so is where he says it is the way we ought to think, whether we be psychologically compelled to or not. Of course, humanism agrees to this. It is only a manner of calling truth an ideal. But humanism explicates the summarizing word ought into a mass of pragmatic motives, from the midst of which our critics think that truth itself takes flight. Truth is a name of double meaning. It stands now for an abstract something, defined only as that to which our thought ought to conform, and again it stands for the concrete propositions within which we believe that conformity already reigns, they being so many truths. Humanism sees that the only conformity we ever have to deal with concretely is that between our subjects and our predicates, using these words in a very broad sense. It sees, moreover, that this conformity is validated, to use Mr. Schiller's term, by an indefinite number of pragmatic tests that vary as the predicates and subjects vary. If an S gets superseded by an SP, that gives our mind a completer sum of satisfactions. We always say humanism points out that we have advanced to a better position in regard to truth. Now, many of our judgments thus attained are retrospective. The S's, so the judgment runs, were SP's already ere the fact was humanly recorded. Common sense, struck by this state of things, now rearranges the whole field, and traditional philosophy follows her example. The general requirement that predicates must conform to their subject, they translate into an ontological theory. A most previous subject of all is substituted for the lesser subjects, and conceived of as an archetypal reality. And the conformity required of predicates in detail is reinterpreted as a relation which our whole mind, with all its subjects and predicates together, must get into with respect to this reality. It, meanwhile, is conceived as eternal, static, and unaffected by our thinking. Conformity to a non-human archetype like this is probably the notion of truth which my opponent shares with common sense and philosophic rationalism. Now, when humanism, fully admitting both the naturalness and the grandeur of this hypothesis, nevertheless points to its sterility, and declines to chime in with its substitution, keeping to the concrete and still lodging truth between the subjects and the predicates in detail, it provokes the outcry which we hear and which my critic echoes. One of the commonest parts of the outcry is that humanism is subjectivistic altogether. It is supposed to labour under a necessity of denying transperceptual reality. It is not hard to see how this misconception of humanism may have arisen, and humanistic writers, partly from not having sufficiently guarded their expressions, and partly from not having yet got round, in the poverty of their literature, to a full discussion of the subject, are doubtless in some degree to blame. But I fail to understand how anyone with a working grasp of their principles can charge them wholesale with subjectivism. I myself have never thought of humanism as being subjectivistic, farther than to this extent that, in so much as it treats the thinker as being himself one portion of reality, it must also allow that some of the realities that he declares for true are created by his being there. Such realities, of course, are either acts of his, or relations between other things and him, or relations between things which, but for him, would never have been traced. Humanists are subjectivistic also in this, that, unlike rationalists, who think they carry a warrant for the absolute truth of what they now believe in their present pocket, they hold all present beliefs as subject to revision in the light of future experience. The future experience, however, may be of things outside the thinker. And that this is so, the humanist may believe as freely as any other kind of empiricist philosopher. The critics of humanism, though here I follow them but darkly, appear to object to any infusion whatever of subjectivism into truth. All must be archetypal. Every truth must pre-exist to its perception. Humanism sees that an enormous quantity of truth must be written down as having pre-existed to its perception by us humans. In countless instances, we find it most satisfactory to believe that, though we were always ignorant of the fact, it always was a fact that S was SP. But humanism separates this class of cases from those in which it is more satisfactory to believe the opposite, e.g. that S is ephemeral, or P a passing event, or SP created by the perceiving act. Our critics seem, on the other hand, to wish to universalize the retrospective type of instance. Reality must pre-exist to every assertion for which truth is claimed. And, not content with this overuse of one particular type of judgment, our critics claim its monopoly. They appear to wish to cut off humanism from its rights to any retrospection at all. Humanism says that satisfactoriness is what distinguishes the true from the false. But satisfactoriness is both a subjective quality and a present one. Ergo, the critics appear to reason, an object, qua true, must always, for humanism, be both present and subjective, and a humanist's belief can never be in anything that lives outside the belief itself or antedates it. Why so preposterous a charge should be so current, I find it hard to say. Nothing is more obvious than the fact that both the objective and the past existence of the object may be the very things about it that most seem satisfactory, and that most invite us to believe them. The past tense can figure in the humanist world, as well of belief as of representation, quite as harmoniously as in the world of anyone else. Mr. Joseph gives a special turn on this accusation. He charges me with being self-contradictory when I say that the main categories of thought were evolved in the course of experience itself, for I use these very categories to define the course of experiences by. Experience, as I talk about it, is a product of their use, and yet I take it as true anteriorly to them. This seems to Mr. Joseph to be an absurdity. I hope it does not seem such to his readers, for if experiences can suggest hypotheses at all, and they notoriously do so, I can see no absurdity whatever in the notion of a retrospective hypothesis having for its object the very train of experiences by which its own being, along with that of other things, has been brought about. If the hypothesis is satisfactory, we must, of course, believe it to have been true anteriorly of its formulation by ourselves. Every explanation of a present by a past seems to involve this kind of circle, which is not a vicious circle. The past is causa existendi of the present, which in turn is causa cognoscendi of the past. If the present were treated as causa existendi of the past, the circle might indeed be vicious. Closely connected with this pseudo-difficulty is another one of wider scope and greater complication, more excusable, therefore. Footnote. This Mr. Joseph deals with, though in much too pettifogging and logic-chopping a way, on page 33 to 34 of his article. End footnote. Humanism, namely, asking how truth in point of fact is reached, and seeing that it is by ever substituting more satisfactory for less satisfactory opinions, is thereby led into a vague historic sketch of truth's development. The earliest opinions, it thinks, must have been dim, unconnected feelings, and only little by little did more and more orderly views of things replace them. Our own retrospective view of this whole evolution is now, let us say, the latest candidate for truth as yet reached in the process. To be a satisfactory candidate, it must give some definite sort of a picture of what forces keep the process going. On the subjective side, we have a fairly definite picture, sensation, association, interest, hypothesis. These account in a general way for the growth into a cosmos of the relative chaos with which the mind began. But on the side of the object, so to call it roughly, our view is much less satisfactory. Of which of our many objects are we to believe that it truly was there and at work before the human mind began? Time, space, kind, number, serial order, cause, consciousness are hard things not to objectify. Even transcendental idealism gives them standing as empirically real. Substance, matter, force fall down more easily before the criticism, and secondary qualities make almost no resistance at all. Nevertheless, when we survey the field of speculation, from scholasticism through Kantism to Spencerism, we find an ever-recurring tendency to convert the pre-human into a merely logical object, an unknowable thing and sic that but starts the process, or a vague materia prima that but receives our forms. The reasons for this are not so much logical as they are material. We can postulate an extramental that freely enough, though some idealists have denied us the privilege. But when we have done so, the what of it is hard to determine satisfactorily, because of the oppositions and entanglements of the variously proposed whats with one another and with the history of the human mind. The literature of speculative cosmology bears witness to this difficulty. Humanism suffers from it no more than any other philosophy suffers, but it makes all our cosmogonic theories so unsatisfactory that some thinkers seek relief in the denial of any primal dualism. Absolute thought, or pure experience, is postulated, and endowed with attributes calculated to justify the belief that it may run itself. Both these truth-claiming hypotheses are non-dualistic in the old mind and matter sense, but the one is monistic and the other pluralistic, as to the world process itself. Some humanists are non-dualists of this sort. I myself am one unsvar of the pluralistic brand. But doubtless dualistic humanists also exist, as well as non-dualistic ones of the monistic wing. Mr. Joseph pins these general philosophic difficulties on humanism alone, or possibly on me alone. My article spoke vaguely of a most chaotic, pure experience coming first, and building up the mind. But how can two structureless things interact so as to produce a structure? My critic triumphantly asks. Of course they can't, as purely so named entities. We must make additional hypotheses. We must beg a minimum of structure for them. The kind of minimum that might have tended to increase towards what we now find actually developed is the philosophical desideratum here. The question is that of the most materially satisfactory hypothesis. Mr. Joseph handles it by formal logic purely, as if he had no acquaintance with the logic of hypothesis at all. Mr. Joseph again is much bewildered as to what a humanist can mean when he uses the word knowledge. He tries to convict me of vaguely identifying it with any kind of good. Knowledge is a difficult thing to define briefly, and Mr. Joseph shows his own constructive hand here even less than in the rest of his article. I have myself put forth on several occasions a radically pragmatist account of knowledge, the existence of which account my critic probably does not know of, so perhaps I had better not say anything about knowledge until he reads it and attacks that. I will say, however, that whatever the relation called knowing may itself prove to consist in, I can think of no conceivable kind of object which may not become an object of knowledge on humanistic principles as well as on the principles of any other philosophy. Footnote. For a recent attempt, effective on the whole, at squaring humanism with knowing, I may refer to Professor Woodbridge's very able address at the St. Louis Congress, The Field of Logic, printed in Science, New York, November 1904. End footnote. I confess that I am pretty steadily hampered by the habit, on the part of humanism's critics, of assuming that they have truer ideas than mine of truth and knowledge, the nature of which I must know of and cannot need to have redefined. I have consequently to reconstruct these ideas in order to carry on the discussion. I have, for example, had to do so in some parts of this article, and I thereby expose myself to charges of caricature. In one part of Mr. Joseph's attack, however, I rejoice that we are free from this embarrassment. It is an important point and covers probably a genuine difficulty, so I take it up last. When, following Schiller and Dewey, I define the true as that which gives the maximal combination of satisfactions, and say that satisfaction is a many-dimensional term that can be realised in various ways, Mr. Joseph replies, rightly enough, that the chief satisfaction of a rational creature must always be his thought that what he believes is true, whether the truth brings him the satisfaction of collateral profits or not. This would seem, however, to make of truth the prior concept, and to relegate satisfaction to a secondary place. Again, if to be satisfactory is what is meant by being true, whose satisfactions and which of his satisfactions are to count? Discriminations notoriously have to be made, and the upshot is that only rational candidates and intellectual satisfactions stand the test. We are then driven to a purely theoretic notion of truth, and get out of the pragmatic atmosphere altogether. And with this, Mr. Joseph leaves us. Truth is truth, and there is an end of the matter. But he makes a very pretty show of convicting me of self-stultification, in according to our purely theoretic satisfactions any place in the humanistic scheme. They crowd the collateral satisfactions out of house and home, he thinks, and pragmatism has to go into bankruptcy if she recognises them at all. There is no room for disagreement about the facts here, but the destructive force of the reasoning disappears as soon as we talk concretely instead of abstractly, and ask, in our quality of good pragmatists, just what the famous theoretic needs are known as, and in what the intellectual satisfactions consist. Mr. Joseph, faithful to the habits of his party, makes no attempt at characterising them, but assumes that their nature is self-evident to all. Are they not all mere matters of consistency, and emphatically not of consistency between an absolute reality and the mind's copies of it, but of actually felt consistency amongst judgments, objects, and manners of reacting in the mind? And are not both our need of such consistency and our pleasure in it conceivable as outcomes of the natural fact that we are beings that develop mental habits, habit itself proving adaptively beneficial in an environment where the same objects, or the same kinds of objects, recur and follow law? If this were so, what would have come first would have been the collateral profits of habit, and the theoretic life would have grown up in aid of these. In point of fact, this seems to have been the probable case. At life's origin, any present perception may have been true, if such a word could then be applicable. Later, when reactions became organised, the reactions became true whenever the expectation was fulfilled by them. Otherwise, they were false or mistaken reactions. But the same class of objects needs the same kind of reaction, so the impulse to react consistently must gradually have been established, with a disappointment felt whenever the results frustrated expectation. Here is a perfectly plausible germ for all our higher consistencies. Nowadays, if an object claims from us a reaction of the kind habitually accorded only to the opposite class of objects, our mental machinery refuses to run smoothly. The situation is intellectually unsatisfactory. To gain relief, we seek either to preserve the reaction by reinterpreting the object, or, leaving the object as it is, we react in a way contrary to the way claimed of us. Neither solution is easy. Such a situation might be that of Mr. Joseph, with me claiming assent to humanism from him. He cannot apperceive it so as to permit him to gratify my claim, but there is enough appeal in the claim to induce him to write a whole article in justification of his refusal. If he should assent to humanism, on the other hand, that would drag after it an unwelcome, yea, incredible, alteration of his previous mental beliefs. Whichever alternative he might adopt, however, a new equilibrium of intellectual consistency would in the end be reached. He would feel, whichever way he decided, that he was now thinking truly. But if, with his old habits unaltered, he should simply add them to the new one of advocating humanism quietly or noisily, his mind would be rent into two systems, each of which would accuse the other of falsehood. The resultant situation, being profoundly unsatisfactory, would also be instable. Theoretic truth is thus no relation between our mind and archetypal reality. It falls within the mind, being the accord of some of its processes and objects with other processes and objects, accord consisting here in well-definable relations. So long as the satisfaction of feeling such an accord is denied us, whatever collateral profits may seem to inure from what we believe in are but as dust in the balance, provided always that we are highly organized intellectually, which the majority of us are not. The amount of accord which satisfies most men and women is merely the absence of violent clash between their usual thoughts and statements and the limited sphere of sense perceptions in which their lives are cast. The theoretic truth that most of us think we ought to attain to is thus the possession of a set of predicates that do not contradict their subjects. We preserve it as often as not by leaving other predicates and subjects out. In some men, theory is a passion, just as music in others. The form of inner consistency is pursued far beyond the line at which collateral profits stop. Such men systemize and classify and schematize and make synoptical tables and invent ideal objects for the pure love of unifying. Too often the results, glowing with truth for the inventors, seem pathetically personal and artificial to bystanders, which is as much as to say that the purely theoretical criterion of truth can leave us in the lurch as easily as any other criterion. I think that if Mr. Joseph will but consider all these things a little more concretely, he may find that the humanistic scheme and the notion of theoretic truth fall into line consistently enough to yield him also intellectual satisfaction. End of chapter 11.
Did you know Microsoft has officially ended support for Windows 10? Upgrade to Windows 11 with an LG Gram laptop. Voted PC Mag's Reader's Choice Top Laptop Brand for 2025. Thin and ultra lightweight, the LG Gram keeps you productive anywhere. And Windows 11 gives you access to free security updates and ongoing feature upgrades. Visit lgusa.com/iHeart for great seasonal savings on LG Gram laptops with Windows 11. PC Mag Reader's Choice used with permission. All rights reserved.